Good evening, and thanks for joining us on The Week in Review. I'm Amanda Vinicky. A nail in the coffin for the Velvet Hammer.
This is a historic conviction, which ranks high in the annals of criminal cases tried in this courtroom.
The once vaunted and powerful Illinois House Speaker, Michael Madigan, convicted on 10 counts of corruption. But it was a split verdict. Jurors spent 4 months in court. They watched undercover recordings that showed how the former most powerful man in Illinois politics operates.
There's a lot of deals that go on.
So what would happen if you recommended me?
This board?
Yeah.
He had tried to convince the jury he did nothing wrong. Even as other lawmakers were snared, Madigan insisted the feds had nothing on him.
Do you know whether or not you're a target of this investigation?
No, I'm not a target of anything.
Madigan's ruin came the same week his one-time nemesis got his criminal record cleared.
I'm signing this as a full pardon. Rod Blagojevich.
I want to say to the people of Illinois two things. Number one, I never raised your taxes. And number two, I didn't do it. It was all political talk.
Meanwhile, days after Mayor Brandon Johnson promised heads will roll, there's turnover at City Hall. Chicagoans get a glimpse of the city's formerly secret gift closet, and fears that federal funding won't come through pause a project meant to keep invasive carp from entering the Great Lakes. And now to our Week in Review panel. Joining us are Dave McKinney from WBEZ, Adriana Perez of the Chicago Tribune, Rob Hart from WBBM News Radio, and our very own Matt Masterson. Let's get to it. And Dave, I'm going to begin with you because you have covered Speaker Madigan for really most of your career. How big a deal is it to see him likely going to prison?
Well, I mean, he basically ran Illinois down to the, you know, down to the smallest village in the state of Illinois. I mean, he controlled everything, the purse strings, the policy. He was more powerful than many governors were. He was arguably more powerful than the state's senators were. And to see him kind of in this diminished state in the courtroom, really no longer in control of his own fate and handed over to the jury was really something. And he wound up, it's hard to tell. Even there, he was stoic, Sphinx-like. That's what they called him, the Sphinx. He looked like he was trying to maintain a strong public face, a confident look. But at the end of the day, I mean, it was a big victory for the government, even though it was a split verdict because they got him on big charges.
So, yeah, Matt, over to you. This was a victory, even though 10 counts, but then there were several where he was either acquitted or a hung jury.
At the start of the week, Mike Madigan wasn't a convicted felon, and he is now. So it's absolutely a win for the government. He faces up to 20 years on some of these charges, 10 and 5 years on other ones, and we'll see what prison sentence he actually gets if he is sentenced to prison. But that's absolutely a win for them. They didn't have to get every single charge on here. That's sort of what this was all about. There was 23 charges. There were 5 separate schemes. They didn't need to nail them on every single one. And they didn't get the top charge, but that is still definitely a win in their books. They called it a historic victory, and you can see why. The prosecutors were absolutely happy with the verdict. I don't think they were thrilled. I think they absolutely wanted the racketeering charge to be a guilty verdict for Madigan there. They didn't get that, but they got him on wire fraud, they got him on bribery, and they convinced the jury that this was a person who was corrupt. So
it's racketeering was that overarching charge, right, that you talked about, where they described it as a Madigan enterprise, that he and co-defendant Michael McLean were running this as a criminal enterprise. You know, Matt, you talked about the sentencing. It could be in addition to prison. There's also a forfeiture hearing. Mm-hmm. They're looking to take his money. What's going on there, and how much?
Right. So that's going to be in May. They initially wanted to do it immediately after the verdict, assuming he was found guilty on any of these charges. So the money that changed hands in these convictions, they didn't all go into Madigan's pocket. It was obviously paid to a lot of these contractors who did no work jobs. But Madigan is the one who's going to be liable for that. So some of this money is going to possibly be clawed back by the government. There's going to be a lot of briefing that needs to be done on this, but it's going to be some sort of financial hit likely to Madigan following this conviction as well.
So in the millions of dollars.
It could be up to that. We'll see what amount actually comes out of it. But that was the initial range was a couple million dollars that it could have been targeted.
Over to you, because this really encapsulates encapsulated how things worked in Springfield, that the speaker, those in power, would say, hey, yeah, I know somebody that would be a good fit for that job. The jury found his co-defendant, longtime friend and lobbyist Mike McLean. They said they believed that it was just lobbying, nothing illegal. How do you parse out what we learned in this jury in terms of how things work behind closed doors?
Well, talking to the foreman of the jury, it seemed like, and I think when you get into a trial where in a situation like this, where there are a lot of details and everything really rests on how do you interpret certain words, how do you interpret certain phrases, how do you interpret someone's tone on a tape, and when it came to, you talk about how. There was no verdict on the racketeering charge, the big one, in the jury room. That was the last one. They agreed on day one of deliberations that they were going to handle racketeering last, and he was about to be found not guilty on racketeering. They had one holdout who wanted to convict, and that is why they did not have a verdict on that particular count.
To have been a juror in that room. Now, Dave, at least one juror seemed to have been put off by things that she heard from, or I forget if it was a woman or a man, either way, the juror was put off by Madigan sort of downplaying relationships, including with McLean. What do you make of that and how his taking the stand impacted the outcome?
Well, that was a dramatic moment, a big decision to put him on the stand. It was a situation where, you know, it started out under very comfortable questioning from his defense lawyer. We heard all sorts of biographical details about him, about how he came from a household where they, you know, his parents didn't tell him they loved him, for example, things like that. But you know, the more he got into it, and the more he talked about it under the defense questioning, it opened the door for the feds to come hard at him, and that included opening up a tape where they had fought to keep it out, but it was called the Bandits tape, where it was a recording of McLean and him talking about these ghost subcontractors at ComEd and how they were making out like bandits for very little work. And so that was,
and they laughed
about it, and that created this kind of thing. And I think one of the things that people did zero in on in that discussion in the testimony was him talking about, well, my friendship with McLean has ended. I mean, it surprised people, because it surprised jurors, because, you know, there were, I think, over 150 audio recordings that got played, and many of them were of Madigan and McLean talking about, you know, dinner plans, and their families were very close, and, you know, there was just a portrait.
McLean had written that he
very
this
close
letter
friendship.
Of I will what stand.
I'll stand on the hill with my musket, you know, ready at the ready, you know, to defend you against all things.
And you had interviewed McLean, I believe he was coming out of a dinner, and
yeah.
He had been questioned by the feds, asked what turn on the speaker, and he said no.
Yeah, he said, you know, it would be an act of betrayal not only against Madigan but against himself. And so it was really surprising to hear Madigan say that you know, they weren't friends. But the thing was that the jurors said that created a mixed bag for Madigan, because then it created this dilemma. Well, they could hear with their own ears how these two interacted, how many dinners they went to together, and yet it affected his credibility. You know, that was the real problem.
He also talked about helping out a woman he said that he met at a block party. He said this was just somebody he met randomly. He was trying to help her get a job. The feds had hammered on this. And as it later turned out, she was the wife of an alderman. This was a politically connected person that Madigan already knew. He didn't just meet her at a block party. And the jurors heard that, and it put some doubt in their minds again, is that he's telling the complete truth when he's up there.
Seems like a very unforced error there, mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. somebody that had this reputation of playing chess when everybody else is playing checkers. Is the adage I've heard I don't know how many times since I started covering Illinois politics. What do you make of that? That Madigan, who was supposed to be smarter, wrote the rules, gets now in trouble for breaking them.
Well, I mean, I guess the interpretation is, or the lesson is that everyone, it comes to you eventually. And even if you've been doing it for decades, even if you wrote the rules yourself, even if you were so detail-oriented, you thought you had every single contingency covered, eventually, over a long enough time horizon, you make a mistake. And that's what happened.
especially when the feds are listening.
Well, and when you consider, I think he was on the stand, Matt, for 4 days, right? That's a lot of time, mm-hmm. a lot of room to be making unforced errors.
Well, so speaking of time, Dave, how did Madigan last so long? I mean, the Sun-Times broke this story that Alderman Danny Solis was cooperating with the feds back in January of 2019, and then he denied, we heard that tape earlier, back in October of 2019, that Madigan said he was not a target of anything. And then 6 months still after the ComEd deferred prosecution agreement, he lasted as Speaker of the House. How?
Well, I mean, it was just sort of a drip, drip, drip effect because, you know, you fast forward from that point to the summer of 2020, and that's when the deferred prosecution agreement with ComEd came out, where the whole scheme involving these ghost subcontractors and Madigan and the bribery all kind of came to light, and it put pressure on Madigan in a way that he had, and scrutiny on him in a way never before he had had to deal with. There was a committee that was formed in the House that the Republicans pushed hard to get there to investigate what was in that deferred prosecution agreement with ComEd, and how did he stick around? I mean, there was an example where Democrats, including the House Speaker,
the now House Speaker, Emanuel Criswell,
chaired that committee. You know, they blocked Madigan from testifying in front of this committee. They shut the committee down before there were any sanctions given against Madigan. And so, you know, it was just a, you know, death by a thousand cuts politically for him. And then finally he had to go.
You know, we cannot escape the irony that as Madigan faces really his ruin, former Governor Rod Blagojevich this week was pardoned. Now, they were both Democrats, but they did not get along. So, first of all, what is the practical impact of a pardon?
The practical impact of a pardon
to
Rod Blagojevich is that his record is clean. All that stuff you remember from 16 years ago, bleeping golden, the tapes, all that, it's off the books for him. Now, he was impeached and removed from office, so he cannot run for a statewide office again. However, because his record is clean, that could set him up to run for Senate in 2026. He could run for his old House seat if he wanted to. So he can run for federal office, and it would be, I wonder if those gears are turning in his head right now, making another run for it and possibly getting that Senate seat not that Senate seat specifically, but that position in the U.S. Senate that he was thinking about 16 years ago when Barack Obama was elected president.
I would not be surprised. He has never turned off the politician in himself. Let's hear from President Trump as to his reasoning. Trump saying that Blagojevich was set up.
It was a sort of a terrible injustice. They just were after him. They go after a lot of people. These are bad people, the other side. So I think he's just a very fine person.
They were fake charges. And the big lie was told by the prosecutor and his office that did to me and my family what they did. But it's over. President Trump saw what happened and how interesting it is that when someone goes through something like we went through and he's gone through what he's gone through, it creates a certain understanding.
Blagojevich, Dave, never apologized. It appears he didn't need to. That seemed like the same Blagojevich that you covered as governor?
Well, I mean, you know, he ahead of his sentencing, he did apologize in federal court when he was trying to win mercy from the late former judge James Zagel. That sounded just like him, but you know, let's not forget that that case, and he was tried twice. Both instances resulted in convictions. The first case was just one, but then the other one was 17 counts, and so a jury of 12 people looked at those counts and decided he was guilty of them. So, you know, the argument about things being, trumped up, and I hate to use that word here, but the idea that these charges were embellished or whatever, I mean, a jury had a chance to look at that and decide. And
as did his peers, and it was nearly unanimous in the legislature. Only one member of the legislature, and that was his sister-in-law, voted with Blagojevich at the time in terms of his removal from office. Now, Matt, Blagojevich, Trump, of course, talking about the weaponization of justice. And this comes as you have the Attorney General of the United States now putting on pressure to drop corruption charges against New York's mayor. Is this the end of the U.S. Attorney's Office going after politicians when you have a president who sees this as the weaponization of the Department of Justice.
I don't think it'll be the end, but we'll see probably changes in how it's done. It was very interesting that the Madigan trial was going on while all these changes are happening in Washington, and just to see a federal prosecution go this way, they might not look like this for quite a while, with a lot less U.S. attorneys prosecuting these types of cases or looking into corruption cases like this, like the drop charges against Eric Adams in New York. It's possible there's less of these cases. I don't think there'll ever be zero of them, though.
All right, let's move on to, because Trump, of course, been very busy otherwise in the Oval Office. He's already held up some federal money that's been promised to organizations and to governments. And that has Illinois leaders, including Governor J.B. Pritzker, wary. So, Adriana, over to you. The governor now stalling a project that is meant to keep invasive carp from reaching the Great Lakes. What is this project?
This project is going to be located at Brandon Road Lock and Dam in Joliet. The idea is to layer some technologies to stop invasive carp from going upstream, and that includes a bubble barrier, a sound barrier, a couple other bubble and sound barriers, but also flushing locks. So a lot of different things to really have that like last sort of line of defense against them, because currently we're relying on electric barriers in Romeoville that are not very reliable.
And these carp, or copi, as Illinois has renamed them, are particularly dangerous?
Yes. Well, the problem with copi is, the silver carp specifically, is that they are bottom feeders. So they feed off of plankton mostly. And that means that they can outcompete and starve native fish and mussel populations, which would have a lot of negative impacts on the fishing industry in the Great Lakes. The other problem is that something in their biology makes them get scared easily when there's a loud noise from, like, boats. So I actually had the chance to go to downstream in the Illinois River to the village of Bath, where they already are infested with silver carp. And when you go out in boats, they literally fly out of the air. Like, they can jump as high as 5 feet, and they can hurt people.
I, too, have been to Bath. Yes, they're massive. Yeah. They're really big and hard and sort of spiky almost, even. What does this signify to you, that Illinois is going to hold up other projects, that this is one, but that more federal funding could be either held, or that Illinois is going to be fearful of it?
I mean, I think that's the question mark for every federal outlay to the state of Illinois that's already been appropriated and approved by the Congress to be spent in the state of Illinois. I mean, we talk about the Asian carp mitigation, but also the Red Line expansion to 130th Street. That's another big question mark. Metra got some federal money to buy those self-propelled battery-powered rail cars. What's going to happen with that? They're supposed to be delivered in 2028. So until we get a handle, or until the courts make rulings on some of the questions regarding the funding spigot from Washington, there's going to be a lot of question marks about nearly every federal outlay to this state.
Adriana, why this project? Of the many areas of certainty and where state government depends on federal money flowing down, why do you suppose this Brandon Road CARP project was the one that was chosen to be paused?
Well, it's my understanding from the governor's office that currently the Illinois Department of Natural Resources doesn't have access to $117 million of federal funding for different infrastructure projects across the state. So it's halted like 70 projects in terms of like cleaning up old mines. And in this case, it hasn't itself halted the Brandon Road project. It's probably one of the most expensive infrastructure projects that the IDNR has been involved in. And the thing is that right now, the funding for the first phase of the project is already allocated, is already available. The issue is that because there's no certainty that the next few rounds of construction will get the necessary federal funding that has already been allocated by Congress, but the concern is from J.B. Pritzker is that they're not going to be able to get it in the future, you know, when it was already approved for this project. So they're pausing right now any kind of property closing. So the state doesn't own some of the property where they need to do some construction. So they can't pass it on to the federal government to continue that first phase of construction.
All right, from the shores of Joliet now to the marble floors of City Hall, Mayor Brandon Johnson this week said that his biggest regret was keeping on disloyal holdovers. He said, if you ain't with us, you gotta go. Rob, what punch did that?
Well, there are so many different ways of saying troubled administration, and I guess having a hard reboot at the halfway point is not going to disabuse anyone of the notion that they're not entirely in control of things at City Hall. And which is so bizarre about this statement now is that normally, new administration, you bring in your own people, and I think there were maybe a lot of analysts, myself included, who thought that maybe bringing on some people who had experience in the Lightfoot administration or the Emanuel administration or even the Daley administration was a sign that maybe he was conciliatory, maybe he was reaching out to the Chicagoans who didn't vote for him or didn't vote at all. But clearly he feels that now that at 14-15% approval, that someone needs to be blamed for it, and it's the people who he inherited when he came in 23.
And so within days of that, we have seen some turnover, a lot of people paying attention to the aviation commissioner, Jamie Ree, who is supposedly retiring, and folks not buying it.
It's all a coincidence. Everyone was intending on retiring before this announcement was made earlier this week. The aviation departure comes at a very critical time for the O'Hare Airport expansion project. They were able to get the buy-in from United and American late last year, so that was a crucial turning point, but you're not there yet. And this is also a very curious departure, given that that United Airlines Denver story got some traction earlier this week. United Airlines building a pilot training facility in Denver, one of their major hubs, and the plans for this pilot training facility could potentially be built out for office buildings to accommodate 5,000 people, the same 5,000 people who currently work at the Willis Tower. So it's a pretty precarious moment for aviation in the city to have the commissioner go away.
It'd be a huge loss for Chicago, of course, to lose United. Now, speaking of Matt, changeover CPS chief Pedro Martinez fought so hard to keep his job, but now we hear that he is in the running for another lead position as a superintendent.
Another holdover from the Lightfoot administration, who's now been forced out. His time in Chicago is coming to an end. I think whatever fighting he wanted to do, and his lawsuit's going to keep going on against the city and the school district and the board, he knows he's moving on. So this is another job in Nevada that he's looking at. He has experience out there in the past.
Fight so hard to keep his job if he was going to then look elsewhere?
He hadn't lost it yet. And I think it only makes sense to have another thing in hand. He has 6 months now of where he's going to be paid. He's still on the job to look elsewhere. And it makes sense to do that. If he wants to leave early, he could do that as well. Of course, there's some major, major work left to be done in Chicago with CPS and the teachers union contract that needs to be finalized. If that's done before he leaves, that remains to be seen. But it's a natural jumping spot where a place he has history. I believe he said his kids were born in Nevada out there. So it's another spot where he's going to go and have a similar job, slightly smaller district, but it makes sense.
Something else that has spelled trouble for the Johnson administration is questions over letting the inspector general into this apparent gift closet where folks that want to give something to the mayor, Johnson, or prior administrations as well could do so. We got a glimpse into that closet this week. May I ask, Dave, what is the point of showing a video versus letting folks in?
Well, I guess to show some level of transparency, but certainly, you know.
Does it do it for you?
It does not click for me, but you know, it looks like they need to have a good garage sale when I see the see the images there.
It does. Now, Rob, this inspector general, there's also a new cataloging that the mayor has said that he is going to do. We also have the inspector general pushing back on both Johnson and his predecessor, the Lightfoot administrations, working with them, apparently trying to obstruct investigations.
Yeah, I think the inspector general believed that the mayor's office was trying to put its thumb on the scale in certain investigations by having a representative of the city's law department sit in on certain investigative interviews, and that this person from the law department was not representing the interviewee, but just kind of there representing the city. So they weren't. So there was the IG's office thought there was a chilling effect by having the city lawyer there, and that would influence the interviewee on what they were trying to say. And as to what some of those investigations. They weren't hinted at specifically, but you could take a look at the language, and I guess one of them pointed directly to the Bally's contract for the casino.
Evidently, these were investigations that the mayor might find embarrassing.
Right, right. Well,
we are going to leave it there. This was anything but embarrassing. We are, however, out of time. Our thanks to Dave McKinney, Adriana Perez, Rob Hart, and Matt Masterson. We will be back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family. The Polk Brothers Foundation. Additional support is provided by...
And that is our show for this Friday night. Join us on Monday night at 5:30 and 10 for the launch of Firsthand Peacekeepers. We talk with local residents and stakeholders working to create peace in Chicago's neighborhoods. Now for the Week in Review, I'm Amanda Vinicky. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and safe. And happy Valentine's Day. All right, Adriana, over to you, because we are all talking about the price of eggs, but of course there's something behind that, and that's the avian flu and fears that it could transfer to humans. What concerns do you have in Chicago, and particularly now with a new Secretary of Health and Human Services who doesn't believe in vaccine mandates?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think it's still to be seen. There's no documented cases, I think, of the bird flu going from person to person, but it's always a concern too with pets, you know, and when a lot of birds and red-breasted and common American answers washed up ashore on Lake Michigan the other day, a few weeks ago, there were a lot of pets nearby. You know, you have a lot of people walking their dogs, so just, you know, making sure that they're not getting close to the dead birds, and that, you know, you're cleaning their feet when you get back home, and that you also don't pick them up.
You reported on all those dead birds along the beach. Has there been a recurrence of that, or was that a...
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports free educational initiatives in the legal profession.